this is the 11th of December, and I'm going to interview Nuala Lucas, who's a consultant anaesthetist, but particularly obstetric anaesthetist. That's your specialty.
Yep.
You're at Northwick Park, I think.
I am, yep.
You trained at University College London.
I did.
And then you went on and to Imperial to do your training.
I did, yes.
How long have you been a consultant?
I've been a consultant since late 2002.
Oh, great. What I'm particularly interested in asking you about, if I may, is what effect COVID had on you personally and your practice, your trainees, the mothers, the babies.
When you say personally, you mean personally at work or?
Well, both work, but also if it's, I hope your family stayed safe. So, but if there is anything that's affected you, then I'd like to hear it, if you don't mind telling me.
Oh, no, I don't mind telling you. I mean, I think that there is, you know, there were two elements for it, because there was there's your professional life. And as an anaesthetist, we were right at the forefront. And I'm married to an anaesthetist who was also right at the forefront. So there were two of us dealing with it. But then there is the personal impact because of the national lockdown. And I've got three children, well, they're grown up really, three of them at university. Two were at university, one was on a gap year. And so there was the impact of the COVID pandemic on us as a family, as there was for, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people all over the world. I suppose if I start with the work one, really. So I work at Northwick Park, which is a very busy North London District General Hospital. We do have some tertiary work because it's actually Northwick Park and St Mark's. So St Mark's is a tertiary referral centre for colorectal diseases. And we, alongside that, we have a huge head and neck unit, lots of max vacs and ENT, and we also have vascular. So we're slightly unusual hospital, lots of acute work, we've got a very busy A&E, but also some tertiary work as well. So on a day-to-day basis, without a COVID pandemic, we are known for being a busy hospital. Trainees like to come to us because they get a huge amount of experience. And it's still not completely clear why, but certainly in the first wave of the pandemic, Northwick Park was hit very, very badly. Thinking back now, from about the end of February, beginning of March, we started intense preparation because we knew it was coming, although we didn't exactly know what it was. Even though I've been a consultant for quite a while, you know, none of us, I think nowhere in the world, unless perhaps you'd worked in, you know, maybe somewhere like Sierra Leone, the Ebola outbreak, but still that wasn't to the same extent as COVID. I don't think any doctor had experienced anything like this before. So we knew something bad was coming and we didn't quite know what it was or what to expect. So there was intense preparation. So there was intense preparation in terms of working out what we were going to be doing clinically. So we knew we were going to be intubating and providing intensive care to a lot of patients. And the other huge talking point at that time was personal protective equipment. So we were dealing with an infectious outbreak and there was a massive amount of discussion about PPE. So we had intensive amounts of training about donning and doffing. And there was a huge anxiety and fear of the unknown. There was a huge anxiety about whether as a hospital, as a department, we were going to be able to cope. How were we going to increase the number of ITU beds, ventilated beds, all those practicalities? Did we have enough ventilators? Did we have enough infusion pumps? Did we have enough staff, you know, in terms of nursing staff to look after these patients in the way that we traditionally understand intensive care? So one nurse to one patient. And alongside this, of course, there was massive personal anxiety. You know, I remember ringing one of my intense, so the first weekend when it starting to come in the UK, the numbers were just creeping up. And one of my very good friends was covering the ITU. You know, my husband's, I suppose, in the winter of his career, and I'm thinking, crikey. And I rang the ITU consultant on call and I said, do I need to be worried about my other half, my husband, because he's, you know, on the older side and I know he's going to be intubating. Is this as bad as it seems? Is it all hype or is it true? And he said, Nuala, it's bad. He said, I've just intubated a 35-year-old. It's really bad. It's not, and there was a lot going on. There was professional anxiety and there was personal anxiety.
Right, right. I can understand that. I mean, I was actually in North America visiting my eldest son, January, February time last year. The outbreak was recognized there. And we got home. We didn't have to take any special precautions, but yeah. We said, because we've got other family here, another son and granddaughter here, that we ought to self-isolate.
Mm.
And we've been self-isolating ever since. It's only in the last 2 months that we've got together with our younger son and granddaughter, and we formed a bubble with them, and we do some childcare with her, and they come over, and so there are five of us in our bubble. You know, it has been a huge, huge impact on everybody.
Our lives transformed.
But get back to your yeah. work side of things. You became aware that this was a serious infectious disease, right?
Yeah.
Women come to you for obstetric care, a particular stage in their life where there's all yeah. sorts of other things going on. So let me turn to that aspect that sure. I'm very interested to hear from you. Did COVID affect pregnant women particularly? Was it something you noted, and how did that change?
So when it was all starting, we had no idea how it was going to affect pregnant women. And remember, similar outbreaks, SARS outbreak in particular, pregnant women didn't do well. And we knew that, and we also know that influenza is not good for pregnant women. So we were very, very worried that it was going to affect the pregnant population, pregnant women more severely in a very adverse way. The first time we had a pregnant patient with COVID, I was actually at the maternal confidential death inquiry, the chapter writing meeting in Oxford. And it was my normal labor ward day, and one of my very good friends and colleagues was covering me. And he rang me at about lunchtime and said, we've got a COVID positive patient. I think she's gonna have a section later on. And I said, okay, I'm coming. You know, I left the meeting, I drove back from Oxford. You know, you could say, well, why did you need to go? Well, I don't think, I wasn't being particularly heroic, and I know that he could have done it fine, but we both just didn't know what we were dealing with. And I didn't feel, I wanted to go to provide support to him. I wanted to go so I knew, so I could find out a bit more about what I was going to be dealing with, how I was going to manage the situation. So I arrived back, and there was just a huge amount of heightened anxiety on the labour ward. You know, it was a really difficult, stressful situation. Tensions were running high. And I remember donning PPE. So there was a huge amount of heightened anxiety on the labour ward. I would say that tensions were running high. And the thing that really stands out for me that afternoon was, you know, going to see the patient. She was also very frightened. She was unwell, but not excessively unwell. In fact, as with most pregnant women, her preoccupation was with her baby. Is my baby going to be all right? Don't worry about me. Is my baby going to be all right? She was a term pregnant patient. She was in labor, and she came in early labor, and she had symptoms of COVID at that time.
But this was her first baby.
It was her first baby, yeah. So the things that stood out for me that afternoon were just trying to organise everybody. We'd done our donning and doffing of PPE. We'd got our protocols up and running. But this was the first time that we were going to have to use them. And, you know, the first time for anything is never a straightforward situation. And just wearing your PPE for the first time and having to provide anaesthesia-wearing PPE, you know, no matter how much you prepare on paper and in meetings and talking about it and writing down, there's nothing like practically doing it for the first time. And, you know, I remember thinking, right, we'll have to change this, we'll have to change that. But the section went off fine. And in many ways, it was a normal section. You know, the surgery proceeded, the baby was born, the baby came out crying, there was a lot of, you know, tears and happy tears and laughter as the baby was fine. And then I was doing the section with my colleague, and he ended up holding the baby for a while for some reason which I can't remember. And you know, it was overall a reassuring experience because we got through it and the baby was fine and the mother was fine and we'd done it for the first time. But there were lots and lots of little elements that we were able to sit down and talk about and say, right, we could do this differently, we could do that differently. So that was my first experience of providing anaesthesia to a COVID-positive obstetric patient.
And her outcome longer term?
She did well. And overall, COVID does not appear to have had an increased detrimental impact compared to the non-obstetric population. The group that seemed to be more vulnerable are women at term. When they get COVID, they seem to be more vulnerable to the effects of, but overall the obstetric population are no more vulnerable than the rest of the population. So there's been a very nice study, something called the UCOS study, and that stands for UK Obstetric Surveillance Study. So UCOS has been around for many years now. It's led by Marion Knight, who's professor of maternal and paediatric epidemiology. I think that's her full title. And she's based in Oxford and she leads the UCOS series of studies. And she led the study on flu previously. And basically what UCOS study, it's got a very good methodology already in place. So every hospital in the country, every maternity unit has a local UCOS reporter. And they can get these observational type studies up and running incredibly quickly. So they were able to collect data very rapidly on women who had COVID infection associated with pregnancy. And the results which were published in the BMJ were mostly reassuring. As with COVID in general, they did demonstrate the vulnerability of patients, of women from ethnic minority groups. And that has been one of the, I think, the most important findings from COVID. It's really highlighted it. I mean, certainly in obstetrics, we've recognized for quite a while the disproportionality in morbidity and mortality for women from ethnic minority groups in this country. And I think COVID in general and in obstetrics has really highlighted that. And I think alongside socio-political discussions and events this year, I think that has been another major talking point from 2020 and something that the world really needs to look at and take forward into 2021. And beyond, of course.
After the initial exposure which you had, presumably there was no transmission from her to any of the...
The baby
was monitored, but there was no quick test then.
That's a really good point. So the other challenge we faced right at the start, of course, there was very limited testing. I can't remember exactly all the details, but it was incredibly difficult to get tests. If you compare the situation to what we have now, in that we've all been sent home with these, I think, lateral flow kits, and we put a swab up our nose and we test ourselves a couple of times a week just to see if we might have COVID. I mean, it's incredible compared to the situation back in March, where it was, you know, incredibly difficult to get a test. So every patient coming through, you know, we didn't know if they were a carrier or not. And there was one of the very early surveillance studies that was published came from a maternity hospital in New York. And they demonstrated that around about 15% of the obstetric population in their hospital were asymptomatic carriers of COVID. And of course, that's quite a significant proportion. And that was incredibly alarming for all of us, because theoretically, any patient coming through the door could be COVID positive. It's not like with elective surgery where you can postpone patients or you can postpone them until you get the COVID test. You know, once a woman is in labor, you can't do anything to stop that. And unlike elective surgery, you can't say to a woman who's coming up to term, well, sorry, we can't handle elective surgery at the moment. You've got to go away and come back in a month when we've got through this pandemic. So just slightly getting off the subject of the testing. So we didn't have lots of testing. And we didn't know. So a big debate was, do we treat all patients of those that are COVID positive? But of course, remember, we don't have clear, it's not easy to have isolation paths on a labour ward. Most labour wards are, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5, many more rooms. But okay, you can isolate a section of that room of the labour ward off. But then what do you do when they go to the postnatal ward? And how can you have enough staff to keep, so that you can keep some staff for the one side and some staff for the other side? So just in terms of defining pathways, you know, COVID, it was incredibly, incredibly challenging. on the delivery suite and in fact on the postnatal ward. And I think, you know, most units came up with a strategy that worked for that particular unit, but there was certainly no easy way to have a national standardized response to this on the labor ward.
What did you do? Did you ignore the fact that a room had been used for?
One thing we did try to maintain was we're fortunate enough to have two theatres on my maternity unit, and we did try to maintain a theatre for patients that we knew were COVID positive patients. So we did at least try to maintain one theatre. Everything had rigorous cleaning, and alongside the main theatre setting in the ITU, there was the COVID cleaning team that were just trundling around 24/7 with their very, very rigorous cleaning protocols. But to my knowledge, and I stand to be corrected, but I certainly think that in the paper Tim Cook and his colleagues published, that no anaesthetist died during the contracting COVID from a patient during the first wave of the pandemic, where they thought they caught it from a patient while at work. I'm not 100% certain, but I think it did demonstrate the anaesthetists right from the start were really on it with regards to PPE. We were fastidious and meticulous about wearing PPE. And I think when we wore PPE, and we all relaxed into it after the first two or three times, we became much more adept at donning it and doffing it, and it became second nature. And I think there is good evidence that when you use PPE effectively, it does protect you.
Okay. If you were writing a guidebook for the future, what to do with another similar virus, apart from what you've said, how would you address the obstetric patient and the obstetric practice? And what guidance would you give for the next pandemic?
In terms of planning, and I think lots of people have suggested that we do need to plan for the next pandemic. I think it's Bill Gates that has said that the greatest threat to humankind is viruses. For planning, I think preparation. We've done it once now with COVID. So, you know, hopefully the next thing that comes along, and I think probably it's better to accept there may be a next thing, not definitely in our lives, but there may be the next thing. We hope it won't be any more virulent than COVID. But planning, recognise the values of setting up standardised protocols and pathways, and they will have to be fairly individualised for hospitals depending on your individual circumstances and what the geography of your unit looks like. In terms of the next time I plan a protocol for this sort of thing, I think the term is it a Gemba walk or a Gemba walk? I wouldn't just write it down and talk about it. I would do practical run-throughs of these pathways, because we learnt a lot from the first few times just of actually doing it. And there's things that you miss when you're sitting and talking about it and writing a protocol. So preparation, but with practical preparation, walking around. I think recognizing the value of standardized care, you know, everybody doing the same thing all the time. Recognizing the value of using personalized protective equipment and using that properly and getting familiar with that quite quickly. I think the other thing that I think we'd have to recognize is just it was incredibly, incredibly stressful, emotionally demanding for people. People were worried about their patients. People were worried about their colleagues. People were worried about their families. And I think the support and the bonds that we formed, you know, there was a real camaraderie and Dunkirk spirit. Am I allowed to say that about it? You know, the way everyone came together. Is that answering your question enough with regards specifically to obstetrics?
I'll give you a little bit of background why I formulate the question in that particular way. One of the thoughts that went through my mind when I had the idea of collecting these stories was, when we look back on the last big pandemic, the major, major, the 1918 pandemic, where millions of people died, we know we've got some literature of the doctors, there were a few anaesthetists, and lots of patients wrote about their experiences. And people said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we knew what they did to minimize the risks to themselves, how they changed their practices? And so I thought, here's an opportunity. We'll actually get some oral testimony on what people did, and we'll make these available in 25, 50 years, whenever it happens again, if they want to. Obstetrics is a linear thing. Having a baby, you can't stop it and delay it, and you can't. But I wondered if there were designs, for example, of layouts that you would choose to modify to make life easier next time round. You can't. Maybe you mm-hmm. If you had a big enough department, you'd make one half positive and one half negative. Red. Well, I'd be very, very happy if Nuala, if you could tell me something about the OAA and their approach to this.
Yeah, absolutely. The OAA, the Obstetric Anaesthetist Association, it's the national subspecialty organisation for obstetric anaesthesia. And we were very concerned right from the outset. And we knew that it would be a challenge in obstetrics. There was a total lack of information. I mean, it was nobody's fault, but there was just no information. We were dealing with this new infection, this new pandemic. But we wanted to support our members. It was really important to us to step up to the mark and support our members right from the start. So we did a number of things. We collaborated with the RCOG, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and our own Royal College in developing guidance for obstetrics. And that was about practical what to do, what strategies you should undertake. So one of the things that we recommended earlier on was that to use epidural analgesia for labor. We recommended early epidural analgesia for labor, and the rationale behind that was so that if a woman did need an intrapartum cesarean section, you could convert the epidural to anesthesia and so avoid a general anesthetic. And we wanted to avoid a general anesthetic because it's an aerosol generating procedure with an increased risk of transmission to the staff in theater. We initially said early epidural, but then, of course, epidurals can sometimes put your temperature up in labor. And then in a patient who have COVID, that's a slightly confounding factor. So we changed it to advising or recommending epidural analgesia in labor. So we came up with practical recommendations about what to offer in terms of analgesia and anesthesia. One of the points that was a huge discussion point for labels was whether or not Entonox was an aerosol generating procedure. And there was a massive amount of anxiety about whether Entonox should be abandoned. And after a lot of discussion, I remember having a long discussion with the chair of the Royal College, our Royal College's group, the aerosol generating procedures group, about whether using Entonox. And we didn't really have any compelling evidence that it was an aerosol generating procedure, although on the surface of it, hyperventilating Entonox which might be a bit alarming, but nevertheless, we suggested that using Entonox was safe with the standard filters that we recommend that are used generally with using Entonox. We came up with recommendations about using what PPE to use in what situations. So the provision of neuraxial anesthesia, spinal or epidural is not an aerosol generating procedure. So we try to offer advice on a standardized approach to PPE. And we contributed guidance to the joint website, the ICM Anesthesia COVID website that the four bodies published. We set up a WhatsApp group for obstetric anesthesia leads. So in the UK, every maternity unit has an obs anesthesia lead. So we set up a WhatsApp group so that obstetric anesthesia leads could share information and ask questions about how they were managing COVID in their situation. And we did a bit of an analysis to see what were the most talked about topics during the COVID pandemic. And unsurprisingly, things like PPE were the most discussed topics. But people have found the WhatsApp group hugely helpful in terms of provision of information. And I think moral support, sharing information. I think a huge anxiety when you're in this sort of situation is, am I an outlier? Am I the only person doing this? Am I the only person worrying about this? And just being able to share information, you know, and know that everybody else is having the same problems, the same anxieties, that in itself is hugely reassuring. Lots of people were writing guidelines. So we set up a dedicated page on the OAA website so that for people who didn't yet have their guidelines in place, they could use, look and see what other people had done so that people weren't replicating the information, the work endlessly. So I hope that, you know, our membership felt supported during the pandemic. You know, I talked about the support and camaraderie in my hospital, but certainly on a national level, you know, I think there was a lot of support and camaraderie as well.
That sounds amazing. And I'm very, very pleased to have heard of those things that you did. Let me ask you then, how have you continued to use that advice? Is it still ongoing? Or have you, as the numbers have and they're not down to low enough yet, but they are moderating. Mm-hmm. Do you still maintain this stance, this policy?
As the first wave eased and numbers went down very dramatically in the sort of early, you know, and main part of the summer, I think that people did take their foot off the gas quite a lot. I would say that people got a little bit complacent about using PPE. But alongside that, while you had a decline and perhaps taking your foot off the gas in another and one way, you also had an increase, the curve in the amount of testing that was going on. So we were better able to identify which patients were coming through who had COVID infection. And now, certainly in my unit, we've got to a much better place where, for example, all the elective cesarean section patients, they're all tested in advance, and we know exactly their COVID status. And patients coming onto the labour ward were able to get tests much more rapidly for them. So I think that's one of the things that has made a massive, massive difference to us. And certainly the second wave for my hospital hasn't been anything like as bad as the first wave. And I do want to highlight that some parts of the country, you know, Manchester, Liverpool, while we've been having a much less bad second wave, they've been having an absolutely terrible time. And, you know, my sympathy goes out to them, and I think they've been doing an amazing job at handling it.
I think the Welsh have been having a bad time as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I recently spoke to a young consultant in Newport, and it was sounded pretty awful, but she wasn't specifically talking about obstetrics. One of the questions I had prepared in advance to ask you was about relatives of obstetric patients, because I've heard some terrible stories, and I don't know how accurate they are, about husbands who weren't allowed to be with their wives during labour. I mean, how did you adapt, or how did you deal with that question in your own hospital?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. So at the start of the pandemic, no visitors were allowed in hospital. And remember, you had very, very sick patients, not just with COVID, but with other conditions, dying alone. And they couldn't see their loved ones. I mean, it's really heartbreaking. And at the time, the start of the pandemic, my mother went into hospital, not with COVID, but we weren't able to see her. So I knew exactly how people felt. It was absolutely awful. There was a short period where many hospitals said, no, the partner can't come with their partner who was having the baby onto the labor ward, either for an elective section or while the woman was in labor. It was a very short-lived period. And then there were very, very intense discussions between groups, including the RCOG, the RCOA, the OAA, birth rights, patient groups, and everyone expressing different views. I mean, everyone wanted to try and keep staff and other patients safe as well. It wasn't just about keeping staff safe, it was about keeping other patients safe, but also recognizing that, you know, that you only have a baby, you know, once, twice, thrice in your life. And for women going through that on their own, it can be incredibly distressing. I'm not suggesting that other sick patients were less important, but we did come up with the ultimate conclusion that partners were allowed to join their partners on the labor ward while their baby was born, with the caveats that they should also wear masks, maintain social distancing, the usual precautions. And I think that that was the right thing to do. You know, I'm not in any way suggesting that obstetric patients are more important, but, you know, certainly my conscience didn't sit completely comfortably with not enabling women having babies to have their birthing partners with them.
Well, I'm very encouraged to hear what you say.
We did our very best to maintain normality.
So it's good to hear that there was a group like yourselves who were looking at this rationally and appreciating the significance. So the question I'd like to know the answer to is about what effect this whole COVID thing had on obstetric anaesthesia, particularly on the service that you were providing. Yeah.
Okay, so we were very concerned, and I think a lot of groups were very concerned at the start, that because of staff that needed to be diverted, trainees and consultants and associate specialists that needed to be diverted to support intensive care services, whether we would have enough anaesthetist on the labour ward to maintain the anaesthetic service on the labour ward. So, and one of the indicators for that is, of course, the epidural rate. You know, if your epidural rate is dropping, is it because there simply aren't enough anaesthetists around? So what we did using the OAA WhatsApp group was we surveyed all the OBS anaesthesia leads, and we were able to demonstrate that the majority of units, 95%, but were able to maintain to pre-COVID levels their epidural service. So patients could rest assured that the epidural service was still working well. It's not just about labour epidurals, of course. We know that labour epidurals can be used to provide cesarean section anaesthesia. And we know if there's a labour epidural service there, we know the anaesthetist is around and helping to keep the labour ward safe. So I feel very confident that the anaesthetic service on the labour ward was maintained during the first wave of the pandemic and subsequently.
Thank you. That's very encouraging. I have another question, not exactly linked to that side of things, but thinking about the baby, because I know you've got two patients when you're doing an obstetric, providing an obstetric service, you've got the mother and the baby. Was there any change in neonatal mortality, perinatal mortality or morbidity that you were aware of that can be attributed to COVID?
So we do believe vertical transmission does seem to happen, but it doesn't seem to be associated with an increase in adverse consequences for the baby.
That's very encouraging. Thank you very much indeed. Your own family, you mentioned at the beginning, you've got, I think, three college age, I don't know what age they are. Have they been able to get on with their own lives?
I think like a lot of young people, it's been a really difficult year for them. So two of them were at university, and of course they had to, their university lives were transformed. One was at university in London and studying science and natural sciences, and everything has just become computer-based. So all the positive elements on the social side of university has completely gone out of the window, and she's, you know, working from home, just doing it. I mean, she does have some tutorials and lectures online, but there's certainly almost, I don't think she's had any face-to-face contact since February.
Wow.
And her twin sister is a medical student in Bristol, and she similarly from February to the summer, again everything was online, including their exams. She just started her clinical year, her first year clinical in September, and she's had a reasonable amount of clinical exposure. I was slightly dismayed one day to hear that they'd been sent home because there was too much COVID in the hospital, and I thought, well, they're medical students, they're going to be exposed to COVID at some time. But I was talking to a colleague whose daughter is studying at Cambridge Medicine, and there was a similar issue there. I don't know if these were one-offs or if it was a generalized trend. And my third daughter was on her gap year and had to disrupt all her plans for the gap year, although she did end up volunteering on the PPE help desk at my hospital. And there was one very funny incident when I rang up asking for some extra PPE, and she said, "You ordered this yesterday. You're not stockpiling, are you?" And I said, "No, I'm not stockpiling." I for young people, I think it's very, very difficult because this group, you know, the teens, 20s, they're the group that are probably one of the least vulnerable to the side effects of COVID, and yet they're paying such a huge personal price to keep other people safe. And I think also the economic burden and the social changes that are going to follow COVID are going to have a huge impact on this generation. And I think it's very, very hard for them. And it has been hard for to watch them, I wouldn't say suffer. I mean, you know, the suffering would be overstating it, but to see their lives being affected so dramatically. But I think all parents feel the same. I also feel that as doctors, you know, we've been fortunate in some ways. We've been able to keep working throughout the COVID pandemic. So although everything is turned upside down, there has been some routine. At least we've been able to go to work. We haven't been furloughed, so we haven't had the same economic impact that many people have had. So, I'm very reticent to moan or complain about the impact of COVID.
Two other things. Have there been any of your immediate colleagues in your department affected? Have they contracted COVID? And if they have, are you aware whether they caught that at work or did they get it at home or what?
So some of my colleagues have had COVID. I'm aware of only one that's had bad COVID. Thankfully, he wasn't. When I'm talking about my colleagues, I'm talking about my anaesthetic colleagues, yeah. Not my surgical or medical colleagues. Only one of us had really bad COVID. He didn't end up getting intubated, thank goodness. He has suffered for a period afterwards. It certainly hasn't just gone away and he's bounced back. Several of us have had milder versions of COVID disease. I must admit, I was surprised that not more of us had COVID in the first wave. I thought that really demonstrated the effectiveness of PPE and hand washing and all the other manoeuvres. But overall, as a department, I'm relieved, slightly surprised that we didn't take a bigger hit COVID-wise directly.
Good. 5 years' time. 5 years' time, certainly. If something similar comes again, do you feel, with the experience you've had, that this will be of value to you, that you've learned enough, you've explained quite a lot about what you have learned. I would think the answer is probably self-evident, but do you feel better prepared for this the next time?
Yeah, I do feel better prepared. I do feel, it's been a totally unique challenge in my career. I did a lot of my training before the European Working Time Directive came in, and I've done a lot of things over the years, but I'd never experienced anything like this. And it certainly prepared me, given me insights into just how dramatically life and my job and healthcare can change overnight. I think, you know, time passes and people often have short memories, and I hope we don't completely forget what we've learned. I think there was a lot of discussion about how the UK as a whole could have been better prepared with regards to PPE, etc. I think it's sometimes very difficult to prepare if you don't know what you're dealing with. And remember, nobody had any idea what this would be like. So I think it has given us insights that I hope we will carry for many years should something else come along. And I hope that we would be better prepared and to be able to step up more. I don't want to say more rapidly, I don't want to be critical in any way of our response, but perhaps step up with less anxiety and stress than perhaps this time round, because I do feel that our response was overall very good.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you. Noella, thank you so much for your time. I know we've broken into your busy working day, but I really appreciate the time to talk to you.
It's really enjoyable to chat.
Well, thank you very much. Good luck, and to your family as well. Hope they get their lives back. We all get our normal lives back soon. All that remains is for me to thank you very much for your time. Okay, and I hope your patients haven't missed you too much whilst you've been.
Not at all. Thank you very much, Mike. Great to chat.